and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week, the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance take you beyond the numbers and hype, right to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week, we're going to meet another of the remarkable and inspirational thought leaders at the forefront of innovation that UBS supports and celebrates through its Global Visionaries program. Today, we meet Dr. Daniel Cordaro, the founder and CEO of the Contentment Foundation, a UBS Global Visionary. Cordaro has spent the last decade of his career studying what it means to live a flourishing life and sharing the findings with schools around the world. His personal goal is certainly an audacious one, to significantly improve the lives of 1 billion children and 1 billion adults, that's a quarter of the Earth's population, within his lifetime. The foundation creates scalable mental well-being technologies and provides transformative programs to schools, families and organizations globally. It's a non-profit that generates revenue by partnering with governments, school networks and corporations. It's a pleasure to welcome Daniel Cordaro to the program. Daniel, just to start off, tell us a little bit about the foundation itself and how it all started.
The Contentment Foundation, in a nutshell, is attempting to support communities all over the world in reducing suffering on a mental health and wellness level. It's one of humanity's grandest challenges that we're facing today, and we exist to support schools, teachers, families at home, and also organizations in creating structures and programs that help improve mental health and wellness, create community safety, and create a sense of psychological flexibility in a very volatile world right now. So that's, in a nutshell, what we do. And I'm happy to talk a little bit more about our history, if that's helpful for you.
Well, yeah, Daniel, absolutely. And we'll maybe come to the work that the foundation does and how it actually engages with all of these communities globally. But maybe to backtrack even a little further, we talk obviously then about well-being, and it's a word that's bandied around perhaps a bit sort of casually almost these days. Can you tell us what you mean by that and talk about these four pillars that build what well-being really means?
This is one of the most fascinating questions that human beings can ask. And in fact, we've been asking this question for around 4,000 plus years. Since literally the advent of human writing, human beings have been discussing this question about what it means to live a flourishing and well existence. And what we mean when we're talking about well-being is that really inside, I feel like I'm whole and complete and living a life of meaning and purpose. And now there's a big question around this, which is, how do you do that? And that's where things get a little bit interesting, because there are so many philosophies across time that try to answer that question of how. And there are different aspects from, you know, making more money and getting more validation and more success on the outside. So these are very extrinsically focused ways of achieving that sense of fulfillment inside. And then there are other really interesting practices that really don't involve anything on the outside at all. Things like mindfulness, compassion, empathy, self-curiosity, understanding the nature of the mind through things like emotional intelligence that allow us to cultivate this sense of wellness inside. So at the end of the day, every human being on planet Earth is looking for the exact same thing. And I would actually argue that every sentient being on planet Earth is looking for the same thing. They just want to live a flourishing life. They want to feel well. But how they go about doing that varies wildly from person to person and culture to culture. So the Contentment Foundation is really here to provide some of the more sustainable strategies to help people get there a little bit faster and do it in a way that doesn't require a lot of extrinsically focused activities on the outside.
Well, one aspect of this that I find absolutely fascinating, and it was sort of high up on my list of things to ask you about in more detail, Daniel, was this idea of an acceptance of our emotional, you know, realities and it being unconditional in character. Can you tell us a bit more about why that's so important and how that speaks to exactly that process that you were just describing to us?
That's a great question. And it's a fundamental question for what it means to be a human being, because as a human being, we experience these things called emotions, which are sub-second flashes of physical and psychological changes that help us navigate different situations in our lives. It's really interesting because we've gone through a long history of wanting to push emotions away and ignore them. But modern science has shown largely that people who understand their emotions and can recognize them as valuable information actually make better decisions. They make better leaders. They can support larger and stronger communities and so on. They're great benefits for understanding human emotion. So what we mean when we're saying unconditional acceptance of those emotions is that really we're allowing ourselves to experience all of the vast continua of emotions that life has to offer. And we can use those experiences as data and information to live life more effectively. So we need to be able to expand our capacity to feel more fear and anxiety and pain and pleasure and desire and everything in between, instead of suppressing and pushing these things away. If we allow them to fully express inside of us in ways where we can use them as information, it helps us understand ourselves better, it helps us understand others better, and it helps us navigate daily situations much more effectively.
So I guess we're speaking about some of the benefits here. It's probably instructive, Daniel, I guess at this stage also, to be mindful of the scale of the problems that some of these benefits and strategies can help address. And obviously, if we talk about people's mental well-being, wherever they are in the world, there are some really arresting and frankly, pretty terrifying data sets looking at, you know, suicide as a cause of death amongst younger people, the access of people young and old to adequate healthcare, including mental health services. How much of a role can the processes that you're describing to us and some of the ideas that the foundation is really engaged in, how much of a role can they play in addressing those very real world, frankly, pretty terrifying sort of data sets?
So first of all, you're absolutely right. Mental health challenges are one of humanity's biggest obstacles today. I mean, we have a lot of grand challenges that we have to solve as a unified species. We have climate change, inequity, all kinds of problems are arising on a daily basis. But one of the problems that underpins many of those grand challenges is actually one of the most hidden ones, and you mentioned it, which is mental health concerns and lack of access for appropriate mental health care around the world. The figures are actually quite stunning. Around 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 people on planet Earth struggle from a mental health issue. Typically, the most prevalent ones are things like anxiety, depression, stress, burnout, but then there are many others in that category as well. So about 1 in 6 people, that's over 1 billion people, are struggling with a mental health concern right now. And you mentioned suicide rates. That's also a really alarming statistic. For young people aged 15 to 29, it's the second most prevalent cause of death for human beings on planet Earth. It's extraordinary. It blew my mind when I saw that statistic. Number one is, you know, heart conditions. And number two is actually suicide, which is bizarre. So this is a very, very real problem. It's one that's not as discussed as others because it's not as obvious. It's something that's experienced internally. And to answer your question, programs that support large-scale preventative practices that enhance well-being and give people the tools to support themselves are massively impactful towards a solution. There's no silver bullet. There's no one-size-fits-all strategy for everyone. But I like to draw the analogy like in the 80s, for example, when many, many cultures on Earth decided, you know, we're going to start focusing on our physical health because eating processed foods and sitting around all day is not helping our physical health and well-being. So I'm going to start eating organic, eat more fresh fruits and veggies, and go to the gym. There was this large physical health revolution where people started to take care of their physical bodies a little bit more. Now we are at the beginning of the mental health revolution. So this is where people are starting to wonder, what are the practices and the techniques that I can do on a daily basis that can keep my mind healthy and strong? So what are the fresh fruits and veggies? What's the gym for the mind? And that's what we're bringing here. It's bringing preventative practices that are easy to use, that anyone can get on board with, regardless of culture or background, and that actually work, so that you can support yourself, so that you can be of great benefit to society. You can be a great parent or employee or loved one, while also focusing on your own wellness at the same time.
Well, Daniel, we might talk in a moment about some particular geographies that seem to have a better connection with that sort of engagement and with a discussion about what it is to live well and to live healthily. But it strikes me from what you said there that one further factor that could muddy the water here is how taboo even discussions of mental health is in some cultures. And this is not exclusive to the Western world. I know there's different challenges in different markets. But is that a constant frustration for you and your colleagues as you're doing this great work, particularly when you go into schools and other institutions and you can see the progress that can be made actually quite quickly, that there is a real issue with just getting the engagement started with this idea of a cultural taboo around mental health?
If we were doing this work 30 years ago, I would say yes to that question. But more recently, the discussions around mental health have become much more mainstream. So our team has actually found it much more easy to have that kind of conversation, even at the government level. So human beings are just astoundingly resilient, and we're problem solvers. And when problems get too great, we start talking about them and trying to figure out ways to solve them. And it just turns out that the mental health problem on planet Earth has gotten so great, where there are massive organizations and government agencies who are very strongly invested in solving this. So you will start to see, it's happening already, but you know, in the next 2, 3, 4 years, you're going to see massive mainstream conversations around mental health and well-being start to escalate. And our team is actually finding it quite straightforward and easy to go into different places and support in the way that we have. So there's enough of an early adoption curve going on right now where we have plenty of work to do. And we don't have to really convince people that this is a need and that it's important. There are a lot of organizations that are asking for it. So it's a very, very promising opening for organizations like us and for the larger conversation around the importance of mental health, that people are having those conversations on a global scale right now.
Well, yeah, and so that's hugely encouraging and reassuring, Daniel. Does that buy-in, whether it's, you know, literal or metaphorical, come then also for all stakeholders, you know, nation states, governments, supranational bodies as well? I sense from your tone of optimism there that's your experience. One always wonders if there's sort of laggards who let the side down, but that's not your experience?
You know, it's just like any new cultural phenomenon. It happens on a bell curve. And right now we're on the very beginning of that bell curve. So there are certainly some nation states and organizations who are openly discussing things like mental health and well-being. New Zealand is one of them. Bhutan is another one. And then there are others that aren't really talking about it at all. But those early adopters are going to inspire the rest of the world, because once they engage in some really strong practices that help support their communities and populations, other nations will see the benefits of those programs and then largely catch on. So we're at the beginning of a catalytic moment for humanity with the discussion around mental health and wellness. So absolutely, certainly, there are plenty of people out there who are uncomfortable with that conversation, but there are plenty of others who are ready to get on board now. And those are the people who are going to drive the next wave of interest in this work.
You mentioned Bhutan there, Daniel, and of course, I was going to ask you about this because, you know, extraordinary kind of pickup of this idea about, do we actually recalibrate how we look at what countries do and what they produce? You know, should we replace GDP with measures of happiness in indices and this sort of thing? And Bhutan always scores very well. Now, mindful, of course, of this distinction, we're talking about the striving for contentment rather than happiness. And I gather that is quite an important distinction. It's not semantic. It's very real. But why is Bhutan such a fascinating prism? I know you did research with your team there, what, back kind of 6, 7 years ago, that was a real breakthrough moment for you. Maybe you can speak a bit to that. But why does Bhutan provide such an amazingly, I don't know, sort of, it's such a sort of extraordinarily focused précis of this broader discussion?
I love Bhutan for a lot of reasons, not just for the research. They are this tiny Himalayan kingdom, about 800,000 people, and it's about this, you know, the size of San Francisco or so. And they came up with this approach called gross national happiness. It was around 30 or 40 years ago. And the concept just really rocked the world in a lot of interesting ways. And the concept was this radical shift away from the idea that GDP, or, you know, the amount of money a country is making, that GDP is not really a good indicator of the health and wellness of the society. So they kind of called it out. And largely other countries started to follow suit from this small Himalayan kingdom that made this bold claim away from convention. And since then, there have been large discussions on the national level on what would actually be a good measurement for human health and wellness. So they coined this term gross national happiness. And since then, nations all over the world have been trying to figure out what that means and how to measure it really well. It's still a work in progress, but it's a work that needs to be done. So there are some countries that are actually starting to measure the well-being of their population, whatever it means to them, and measuring that along with GDP, which is also an important measure. But GDP does not necessarily correlate with the health and wellness of the population. And in many instances, it can actually run opposite for different reasons that we could discuss if that's interesting. So, you know, that's where this gross national happiness thing came from. My relationship with Bhutan happened around 5 years ago when I was a part of this fascinating research project out of UC Berkeley. I was the director of the Universal Expression Project, where we were traveling all over the world to decode the human language of emotion in different countries around the world. And one of the places that we traveled to, it was the final location on our long roster of cultures that we studied, was this remote group of people living in the high Himalayas of Bhutan who had largely been uncontacted for their entire existence. So, you know, they were nomads that had traveled there some hundreds of years ago. No one really knew how they got there. And they're one of the last isolated people left on Earth. You know, for those who are wondering, you know, why would you go and disturb them? It's because the electrical company had just built their power lines and they were about to turn the power on, and they had just built their roads. So they were going to start to integrate that community into the rest of the country. So this was our last chance to actually go there and work with this incredible group of people that had been largely uncontacted. So we went out into the high Himalayas. We traveled for many days out into this remote place. And the question that we were bringing with us is, are emotions universal? Are they something that we all experience as a shared language of our common humanity, or are they culturally driven? Spoiler alert for that research project, it's a combination of both. But on this trip, we were able to really get the data that we needed to make the determination that there are certain emotions that are absolutely universal, because these people who had no contact with the outside world were able to recognize them. However, while we were there, there was one emotion that I was studying that stuck out like a sore thumb. It was like the itch at the back of my brain that I couldn't scratch. It was the rogue. It behaved differently. And while we were there, this group of people pointed to that emotion. And they said, this is the most prized state. This is the one that means the most to us. And the word that they used to describe that emotion was chukshe, which literally translates to the knowledge of enough, or knowing that right here and right now, you are whole as you are, regardless of what's going on the outside. And when I heard that, I got chills down my body. It was like lightning struck. And I knew why this emotion was sticking out of the data set like it was. And from that day on, I decided to dedicate my scientific career to understanding this really fascinating experience that human beings can find in their lives, where right here and now we can experience this wholeness of who we are, regardless of what's happening in the outside world. So that was the catalyst to a larger and deeper study of contentment, which then led to practical practices that we're now bringing into schools and communities worldwide.
Daniel, is that moment of recognition of that knowledge of enough? And I guess this also speaks to that acceptance of emotional realities, whether they're, you know, whether it's fury or disappointment or sadness or whatever it might be. Is it an active process? Because I guess some people will say, look, psychologically, this feels passive, an acceptance, a resignation. Does it matter whether it's an active or passive process, even in terms of how people perceive it?
So this is actually a common misinterpretation of what the word contentment means. And I'll just put it out there that I actually don't really care what people call this state as long as they have the opportunity to cultivate it for themselves. Contentment is often confused with words like complacency or passiveness or laziness, and it couldn't be farther from the truth. You know, let's say Tom, you and I are having a discussion and we both disagree on a topic. Things are starting to get a little bit heated. We start getting a little bit angry. And typically anger arises when we feel like we've experienced an injustice. So maybe you hold an opposing viewpoint that I feel is unjust. So I'm starting to feel this thing called anger. Now, if I don't like anger and I don't have a good relationship with anger, what I will likely do is try to suppress it and push it away. And that may lead to an even more unpleasant conversation where I may walk away because I don't want to experience this thing that I'm feeling inside. I may say something to you that I regret. I may lash out because the pressure of suppressing that anger bursts through and, you know, I flip the table in a rage. And that wouldn't really lead to any productive conversation whatsoever. But someone who is practiced with contentment, which comes from Latin contentare, meaning the contents of something, meaning you can have the container for all of the experiences that life has to offer. What I would do in that case is feel that anger inside of me, understand what's happening, and use that as information to communicate with you what my viewpoint is. So I'd say, you know what, Tom, I really disagree with what you're saying. And, you know, I'm noticing feeling a lot of anger around this because, you know, what you said is to me a little bit unjust, and this is how I experience it. So contentment can actually help us navigate uncomfortable conversations. It allows us to be comfortable being uncomfortable and then use that emotional information as data so that we can make better decisions and have conversations that really need to be had but are otherwise avoided because of the uncomfortable feelings that they make us feel sometimes. So that's one example of where contentment is a very active process. It can often be very challenging to do, especially when we're pushing away certain experiences that we would prefer not to feel. Contentment is kind of like a superpower where you allow that emotion to exist in the space of the conversation or the experience, and you can use it to your advantage to make better decisions and to navigate the situation more effectively.
I love that idea, Daniel. It's brilliant. And I love how you explain it. Let me ask you then about, I guess, the nuts and bolts a bit more of the Contentment Foundation and the work that's actually done by yourself and your colleagues. And I wonder too, is it this old truism that actually children and young people, especially in an educational setting, in an institution, are, you know, sponge-like in their ability to receive information about the processes that you're describing there? And are they the best, like learning languages, are they the best at mastering this in a very unquestioning way because they're hungry, because their brains are still forming? How does that process work when you and your colleagues communicate those ideas to them?
It's extraordinary, really. And of course, it depends on the age group, but our really young kids, you know, kindergartners, 3, 4, 5-year-olds, like you said, are just like sponges. And mostly they teach us about contentment because they are just open to everything. When they have a new experience that they've never had before, they get super curious about it and they want to learn more about what it was that they just felt. And then what happens is over time, we start to learn from our culture and, you know, what we should and shouldn't be doing. We start to develop unhealthy relationships to certain emotions. So young children are really, really good at this naturally. And so what we do at the Contentment Foundation is just provide some activities and tools and exercises so that children as young as 3 years old can be able to understand themselves a little bit more deeply than, you know, not having this information at all. And then for older students, as well as teachers and administrators, faculty members, and even parents at home, we have great adult training so that you can learn how to flex that muscle later in life as well. So overall, it creates, you know, this safer, healthier, more open community where people are more comfortable with what they're experiencing inside, and they're using that to actually add to the community in powerful ways.
Daniel, I think I mentioned earlier that it was hard to have this kind of discussion and to explore these themes entirely without the context of the global pandemic, of course. Now, I recall, I think a piece, was it in the Washington Post, I think that you wrote in, I don't know, a couple of months ago about, you know, the understandable nature of people's anxiety, very real hardships, loss, etc., that people are feeling right now. And I just wonder, does a moment that we're living through, an event like this, which affects pretty much everybody, pretty much everywhere, does that represent, not to be glib about this, but is it an opportunity to really move the needle on this discussion? Is it beyond just a change of context? Does it really mean that you can achieve more, you can advance some very ambitious personal and professional objectives that you and your colleagues have at the foundation? Is there an opportunity? Is there something positive that can come out of a pretty difficult time?
You know, it could be seen that way, but actually we have a very different approach at the Contentment Foundation to what we do. We don't convince people that mental health is important. We find people with needs in the mental health space, and we provide them with the services that hopefully they're looking for that can help them. So we're constantly on the lookout and just simply offering our services to the world, to people who could use this the most. And what the COVID-19 crisis has revealed for a large section of humanity is just how important having preventative mental health practices is, especially during times of volatility and uncertainty, like what we're experiencing now. So I believe at the present moment, COVID-19, as of this date, has impacted about 14 million people on a physical level. There have been about 14 million cases. The real number of cases might be 2 or 3 times larger than even that. But on a psychological level, COVID-19 has impacted about 7 billion people on a psychological level. People are experiencing massive stress and anxiety and burnout, sense of isolation and depression. There's a lot of uncertainty, which can be scary and disruptive. So people who have a really strong foundation of personal mental well-being practices are able to navigate this crisis a little bit better than those without those practices. So largely what we're seeing is this big wake-up call on planet Earth that having a mental well-being practice for yourself and for your community is actually really beneficial. It's a nice strategy to support during times of uncertainty. And when things are going okay, which hopefully, you know, in some time, we're going to all get out of this as a global community. And once we do, mental health and well-being practices can get us from 0 to +5 instead of just from -5 to 0. So it's a really great call to humanity and a call to action to just get interested in what might be beneficial for you as an individual and as a collective to support the mental health and wellness of everybody in your circles.
Well, Daniel, I'm mindful of the time, but just briefly, you mentioned a call to action there. What would be, do you have a sort of a clarion call that you issue to people? I guess we might have listeners to say, this really strikes a nerve with me. That really speaks to my human experience. How do I get started on this road? Is it the sort of, you know, that Buddhist mantra of the, you know, the longest journey, even just starting with a single step? Is it about that idea of getting started on a journey? What would you say to people?
The very first step is curiosity. So just the fact that, you know, something like this can bring the importance of mental well-being to people's awareness is just massive. Because once you bring your awareness to something, it becomes a part of your reality, even in a small way. So step one is just getting curious about what it means to be mentally well, and maybe noticing inside of yourself these times and feelings of unwellness. Are you feeling stressed? Are you feeling anxious? Are you feeling lonely or isolated? And the question is, are there practices out there that can support with those things? And largely the answer is yes, there are plenty to choose from. So then step two is to activate that curiosity and start researching different ways to manage anxiety and to build community, to reduce the sense of loneliness and to increase the sense of connection to others. There are tons of great resources out there. Contentment.org is just one of them, but there are many, many organizations and places out there to get new practices to start supporting yourself right away. And these practices are not super fancy. You don't need any advanced equipment. You don't need to pay a ton of money to access the services. A lot of these things are just simple, free, and easy things that you can try at home, like a simple mindful breathing practice. It doesn't cost anything to sit there and watch your breath. But over time, the benefits are just absolutely massive. So there's a very small time input and then a really, really big return on that time investment later on if you continue with the practice. So number one, curiosity. Number two, activate that curiosity and start doing research into practices. And then number three, reach out to organizations that speak to you so that they can start helping you and your community right away.
Dr. Daniel Cordaro, the founder and CEO of the Contentment Foundation, thank you so much for talking to us today. And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle 24. You can find out more about the work of Daniel and his colleagues and partners in the Contentment Foundation. Visit contentment.org. And for more about all the global visionaries in the UBS programme, head to ubs.com and search Global Visionaries. In the meantime, you can listen again to this and every episode of the programme, including our archive of other brilliant visionaries at monocle.com and on all good podcast platforms. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.